Hello, and welcome back to the Life and Death Podcast with me, Stephen Rumford, brought to you by Ashgate Hospice. I've worked in palliative care for 25 years, so in this series I sit down with all different types of people to discuss their experiences of death, dying and bereavement, with the aim of finding a deeper understanding of what life and death means to them. In this episode, I'll be speaking to comedian Ed Byrne. You may know him from his appearances on panel shows like Mock the Week and Have I Got News for You, and for his sold-out stand-up shows across the UK. He's touring a new show at the moment. It's called Tragedy Plus Time. I've seen it. It's very, very funny. And I wanted to speak to him about what inspired the show. In 2022, Ed's younger brother, Paul, died following complications from Hodgkin's lymphoma and from damage that he had suffered to his liver. This might not sound like an obvious source of inspiration for a comedy show, but Ed had everyone in the crowd here in Buxton roaring with laughter, and then shedding some tears too, myself very much included. So as I said, I saw the show in Buxton, and I actually chatted to Ed the next day ahead of his show in Bakewell. We met in person at Bakewell Town Hall, and if I'm honest, I was a little nervous. He did get a little choked at the show I'd seen, and I do ask him about that in our conversation. So I wasn't sure how sensitive he would be with the questions I was asking about Paul. As it was, we talked a lot about Paul, who also worked in the comedy business. We talked about Ed's grief and some of his fresh feelings about that. And indeed, he did get a little emotional during that part of our conversation. And I really appreciated his vulnerability, his openness, his honesty and directness throughout. So all of that and much, much more coming up on the episode with Ed Byrne. So, Ed, welcome to the podcast, and thank you very much for coming along. I had the great good fortune of seeing the show last night in Buxton.
Yep.
Very funny, obviously. You know.
That's the main thing.
Good. Beautifully written.
Cheers.
I wonder how much you... It felt very well written, it didn't feel tight, but it felt like a very tightly crafted show.
Yeah, it's the first time I've done a show where from very early on I had to run it as a work in progress for like an hour in a way that previously my shows have been assembled. They've just been selections of stand up and it's just a question of what order they all go in that makes it flow nicely. So the various bits of stand up would all just be crafted and honed in comedy clubs where I would just, you know, you have a bit about this, a bit about that, a bit about the other. You realize this will go nice here. You write another joke that joins this bit to that bit. And you're just assembling different, almost like putting songs together on an album and finding what order they work best in. But you're trying out all the stuff in comedy clubs. Whereas this one, I needed to put it in a black box theater where I could do a work in progress for an hour and tell the story. And have, you know, and sort of have that safety net of, as it were, a lack of expectation on the part of the audience where they know it's a work in progress. They've not paid a great deal of money to get in. They know they are guinea pigs and they're part of the writing process. I needed to do that quite early on because of the nature of the show. It felt weird I couldn't rock up to a comedy club and go, so here's a story about the death of my brother. And it's going to take at least 45 minutes to get it out. You just can't really do that.
I mean, I want to talk about Paul and go back to the time to some degree, if you're willing. But just to stick on the show, maybe, because we started with it. You know, you call the show Tragedy Plus Time, a quote from Mark Twain about what comedy is.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of the show, you talk about what time is a time at which a tragedy can become
sure
a gag, a comedy routine or whatever. And... the show sails extraordinarily close to that, so that there are moments, and I'm thinking in particular of the last bit of the show, really, when you're in the room, you've been called to the hospital, mm-hmm. your brother's in a coma.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we can talk about that, but just in that moment, you're there with your mum.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing the medics must have said, look, it's we just, he's only kept alive by these beeping machines. Only thing that's doing it here. And I must say, I'm feeling like, in that moment, in my head watching it, I hurtled, as it were, into your mother's being.
I understand what you mean.
But I felt that, like, oh my God, you're there with your mum and she's there looking at one of her sons in a coma.
Yeah.
And in that section of the show, you fire, you even say it, you're like, if that one didn't land, don't worry, there's loads more to come. Yeah. It's a very quick, almost quick fiery sort of time. What did you intend, if anything, the audience to feel during that, where there were these really strong emotional dynamics going on in you and communicated to the audience?
Well, as you remember with that bit, it's sort of the saddest moment of the show, but it's followed instantly by one of the biggest gags of the show. And it's a new thing for me as a stand-up to do, but it's not a new thing in comedy to have a sad moment punctuated by a big laugh. I mean, if you watch MASH or even, I don't know, Ted Lasso, Scrubs would be another example. Even episodes of Friends where they really go hard on the Ross-Rachel breakup, you know, that thing of having a very serious, sad moment punctuated by a big laugh. It's a thing. It's a thing, and it's what makes comedy very, effective as an art form, I guess. And it just illustrates for me and to the crowd how comedy is the thing that we used as a family to get through the whole thing. So that's kind of the point. The thing about talking about actual removal of life support, for instance, it was trying to decide what to include and what not to include about the whole story. And at one point, I had a slightly more graphic description of the death. And it just was too much. And you know, in Edinburgh, a couple of people were walking out and stuff like that because it was it brought back too many visceral memories for other people. I think I had the phrase "noise like a haunted cappuccino machine" at one point was in there, and it was just a bit much. But I guess I just wanted to get across just that how horrible the situation was, because, as you know, as part of the story, myself and my mother left the room at one point, and I'm trying to explain why we would have done that, you know. But yeah, I thought that was a bit too much. But there was a lot to do with the end of, when he was coming to the end, there was a lot of stuff that I was trying to decide whether to include or whether to not include.
How long is it? How long are you running? How long is it going on?
Oh, I mean, I'm on tour till the end of the year, and then this stuff will probably be happening next year. Like, I'll be doing this for a good while. And I think part of it is the fact that it is being very well received and the feedback has been very strong. I am aware that when I stop doing this show, it will be another stage of the grief process. It'll be another letting go. At the moment, the show, weirdly enough, is kind of keeping him alive in another way. And once I'm done with this show, that'll be another thing to have to say farewell to, you know. Because one thing that a lot of people have said now who knew him is that it was like getting to spend another hour in his company, which is quite a nice thing to hear. So that's you've seen the show, it can be quite difficult at times to do it. It takes a lot out of me performing it, but it is quite gratifying.
Yeah, I mean, that was going to be my next, if not question, my next sort of, is that there was a moment. And again, I think it's in that section in the room, and you clearly visibly choke.
I find when there's people I know in the audience, or there's people that I know knew Paul in the audience, that makes it more difficult again. And so, yes, I am aware that the show is more affecting when I am visibly affected by it, but I decided very early on that I was not going to be somebody who would manufacture that or
contrive. Oh no, you said you didn't feel. You felt very, very in the moment.
But I am aware that I could do that,
right,
and make the show equally affecting every single time I do it. But I just think that would be cheap, you know. But yeah, well, I mean, when I first started doing it, I couldn't not cry every time. first sort of week of the Edinburgh Fringe. It was I think it was probably about the second week of the Fringe, with the first time I performed the show with a completely dry face all the way from start to finish. And then all it'll take is maybe it's just I'll hear somebody in the audience who'll just make a sort of a sound or something like that.
Because there were those. That's kind of what I was getting to, I think, with the earlier point. There is a, it's extraordinarily funny. I mean, I was crying, I was laughing. I'd have been crying with laughter.
Sure.
And then you would hear those sharp intakes from the audience, or those ahs, which I think are genuine. I think they're spontaneously moments of empathetic resonance that goes on within the show, which is why it's so rich, because you're laughing. You're like, oh my God, I can't believe you said that, or whatever. And you're laughing. And then you'll say something else. And the next bit, you're like, your heart is pulled to feel something for that, because you've communicated it so authentically. And I don't just mean with your choking. I think the whole thing has a level of authenticity. But there's an incredible sense of presence. Again, that may just be the skill of your talent. You're a talented man. But it comes across as a very kind of, you're present as the writing, but then you're very present in it.
Well, it's funny. It's in exactly the same way that you can tell a joke 100 times and then an audience will just laugh at it, particularly on a night, and you find yourself laughing at the joke again. You know, and again, that also is not, that's again a thing that comedians can often contrive, you know, just to get an extra bit of laughter from an audience, is they'll laugh along too. But sometimes you genuinely do. You can have told a joke 1,000 times, and then for some reason it'll just hit with an audience in such a way that it makes you giggle too. And so it's like that, this stuff, this story that I'm telling, that has a number of different points in it that'll just catch me. Mm. If they just catch an audience a particular way, I'll find myself, you know, going along with them and tearing up, talking about my sister's speech at the funeral, talking about the moment when he died, talking about the argument that we had, reading out the WhatsApp messages from him. You know, it's various, and sometimes it could be just something that totally surprised me, something that's, you know, relatively innocuous usually, will just hit me one night.
But I think that's the nature of grief, isn't it? I mean, I remember when my dad died, I wasn't especially close to my old man. I loved him and he loved me in his own drunken alcoholic way, I think. But there were times where in the sort of first 6 months after he died, I remember seeing a guy who was at work at the hospice, and I was walking some chap who was about my dad's height and had a very similar kind of hair style to my dad's. And I just looked at it and it just cracked me. I was fine. I thought I'd got over everything. So it's funny the way it works, the prompts that can come.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just shows that it isn't, it's there, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of there somewhere still.
I remember doing a festival near Cambridge called the Club Festival. It was Lionel Richie was headlining. I was doing a comedy tent, but my friend Glenn played it the day before, and he just texted me, says, just warning you, there is a guy at this festival who is the spitting image of Paul. just watch out for that. I didn't see him, luckily, but yeah, it is one of those things where...
Yeah, they could just be the trigger. Can you say a little bit about Paul? Because we've been talking about him all this time, and I know that he was involved in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
He was a writer himself, a director.
Director, mainly comedy director, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, people who spoke about him, who worked with him, said that he was part director, part writer, part therapist. His thing was taking people's darkest trauma and feelings and helping them turn that into comedy. That's why it seemed so fitting to do this show, to take his death and turn it into comedy, because that was, you know, he would help people do that. You know, a lot of people, like John Hastings was one of his early clients, and a Canadian comic who did a whole show about a time he was sexually assaulted. You know, and, you know, a story that he hadn't really told anyone, but with Paul's help, he ends up doing it on stage, you know. So that's the kind of guy that was kind of the thing he did.
Yeah.
And his thing was always, you can be as dark and you can be as honest and the story can be as sad as you like, but there has to be a joke. You can't just stand there and tell a sad story. It has to be funny. Otherwise, this isn't comedy. You know?
Okay, yeah. And you were close?
Yeah. I mean, there was a 5-year age gap, and I left home at 18. So we didn't really become mates until we were both adults. You know what I mean?
Mm.
I shared a room with him, but he was 13 and I was 18 when I left home. We were obviously not mates. He was my little brother, you know. And then it wasn't until, you know, he was well into his 20s before we were actual pals.
And so Paul, in terms of as his health, you, again, you speak about it in the show, lots of his health was, as it were, self-inflicted or self-induced or lifestyle or however.
Yeah, I mean, he was a drinker, and I think his real problem was that he just thought he was going to be all right, and then he just ran out of road. He drank himself into the hospital at the Edinburgh Fringe, because the Edinburgh Fringe is just a place where you do a lot of drinking. Bars are open till 5 o'clock in the morning. So it's not like he put himself in the hospital because he'd been dumped or lost his job and then became, you know, a depressive alcoholic. So he was just out drinking. You know what I mean? He was just a party guy. I'm not trying to denigrate anybody else's alcoholism or anything like that. I'm just saying that was the sort of drinker he was. I didn't think, from my perspective, we were all drunk all the time, and his liver just couldn't hack it. So they said to him, "You can't do this anymore," and he gave it up. And then, as I say, 5 years after that, he got Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I always do wonder about the fact that they said to him that his liver had regenerated to an extent. Because the liver is an incredibly resilient organ, and it does regenerate. And so they were able to treat him with chemotherapy that they wouldn't have been able to hit him with had his liver still been in a poor state. And I often wonder if that knowledge was, you know, part of then what later made him think, when he did go back on the sauce following a breakup, that he thought, it'll regenerate. I can get away with this for a couple of months just to get me through this bad patch in life, you know. So he had the lymphoma, and he was treated with chemo. It did damage the liver further. But as I say, he was grand. And then you get a lot of different health issues when you've had that kind of chemo. So he had thyroid issues and stuff like that. And that sort of stuff can also then can make you less worried when you then get unwell. Do you know what I mean? So then when he did, then in the second lockdown, he got dumped. He had no work. We don't know exactly for how long he started drinking again, but I do know that he gave it up again, but he just went back on it. But he was then ill. And because he'd had so many different health issues, a sort of shortness of breath, for instance, is just like another one on the list. And it turned out that the reason he had shortness of breath is because his lungs were full of fluid, because his liver had packed up, you know.
So going back to your, I suppose, feelings around all of this, really. I mean, you know, you'd had the ding-dong, as you call it. I could joke about that in the show. But you'd had this spat, you know, typical sibling kind of engagement, really, in a way. I haven't got any siblings, but I believe it's a typical sibling thing. And then it becomes obvious just how seriously ill Paul is and how limited his life is. So there'd been a rapprochement, as it were, between you or via text, where it started to get going. When did you realise that he was going to die?
Oh, not until he was going to die, not until he was in that final coma. I thought he was going to be all right. I was very optimistic about the whole thing. And so was he, you know. I look back and I thought, maybe I should have, you know, just throwing money at the problem and put him in a private hospice until such time as he was ready to be, you know, for the transplant. Just to buy him that extra time. But it just felt like a lot of stuff just didn't line up, basically.
I don't know if I do want to ask you about how you were after. I mean, it feels so personal, and it's funny, you do a show, and yeah, I'm sat here and I feel quite intrusive on your story in some ways. Maybe that's just me.
Well, you know, it's, I mean, as I say, it's a story I've been telling nightly.
But here I am just sat with you rather than you're giving it as a thing. But if I'm going back to my genuine curiosity rather than just a kind of voyeuristic questioning, I'm sure you, of course, there was grief, and you can say to that if you want to talk to that. I think what I'm interested in some ways is when the point comes for you, when your grieving becomes a provocation for your art.
Yes.
I mean, maybe it's just that you're an artist and you use the material in your life as any artist will, and how are you going to avoid using this? I'm going to have to work this out in some way. Or did it actually come to you as like, this is more actively positive than simply, I have to use the stuff I use and this is what I do for a living. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it was a couple of things. First of all, I remember when we were just in the hospital in November after he'd gotten sick, and he told a joke that's in the show about the whole notion of waiting for somebody else to die so you can have their liver, that whole thing. There's a joke about that, which he came up with. And the way I tell it in the show, I make it sound like he just basically said the joke. But what he actually, the context in which he told me the joke was, he was planning on giving this joke to his friend John Hastings in case he was going to, you know, do stuff about his friend dying or nearly dying, you know. So he was already thinking, he was already looking at the comedy angle.
You could see the material
of what was happening to him.
Mm.
So that, you know, and I didn't say it to him, but when he said, and I was going to give this joke to John Hastings, I'm like, why wouldn't I get this joke? I'm your brother. And then what was funny was then I talked to John Hastings and said, no, he told me he was going to give you that joke. I know, he really told me he was giving it to you. And by which time John had, because this is the other interesting thing, Paul was directing a bunch of people at the time of his death. A bunch of people were planning to go to the Edinburgh Fringe that August with shows directed by Paul. And four of those shows became about my friend Paul, who's my director, and then a reveal at 45 minutes, and then he died, you know.
And you saw these shows, presumably.
And I saw all these shows, yeah. I saw all of them. So there was five or six acts at the Fringe that year doing stuff about it. And I just felt like, you know, I think my perspective was also valuable. So yes, it was fairly early on. And I remember doing another podcast about grief. And I did that probably a bit too soon. I did it like 3 months after he died. I just found it very beneficial to do. And I remember saying in that, you know, I suppose the next step is try and turn this into something. Because that's the other thing, is that whatever is going on in my life is whatever that next show ends up being about, whether it's having kids or getting married or breaking up with a girlfriend or having a hernia or getting a cat, you know, whatever it is, that's what the show ends up being. And, you know, this is pretty much all I've been able to think about for a while. I've moved on somewhat now, but certainly at the time, that first year, that was just all that was on my mind. I think a funny thing when something like this, or when a sibling dies and your parents are still alive, is that one thing that does happen with the grief is that it delays it slightly, because you are busy concentrating on your parents and their grief, because losing a child is the worst. So it's weird. It delays the whole thing sinking in a bit, because you're concentrating more on what your parents are going through, to the extent that it's only then after everybody's gone home and probably after the funeral and everything like that, that you suddenly go, I miss him too. You
know? Yeah. Are you ready for another couple of things?
Yeah.
It's about humour, I suppose, and death, generally, isn't it? It used to be tax and death, and in there we're just going to talk about humour and death. But within the hospice world, I'm struck, it may just be me, that there is a lot of gallows humour.
Oh, I bet.
There is a lot of gallows humour.
I'm sure.
And I think humour is a way around, when it is around death, dying, or, you know, tragedy in some way, it does allow you to stare at it. It's a bit like looking at the sun and putting sunglasses on in, but not sunglasses, but, you know, the things you do at the eclipse. It gives you a means to look at these things as directly as you can. Do you know what I mean? It's a sort of, I'm mixing my metaphors, it's a filter, or it's some means whereby you can look at this stuff. And I think that's what your show did, or does, I'm sure. But last night what it did, and those oohs and ahs, and and I made a little noise much like that. And so, but I went, like a little kind of whimper. You're allowing us to come with you and be in that room and be in those moments. And, you know, and it makes it very powerful. It makes it very, very powerful, in fact. Anyway, you probably know it. I suppose, well, the other thing I wanted to ask you about it is, you said it had done well. Of course, there's been 5-star reviews, apart from the 4 stars from The Guardian, which I've particularly enjoyed. But has there been feedback around that was really good for me because I've just lost my blah, blah.
Totally. And but also negative. In fact, I just got a message on Twitter from somebody who was at the show last night who didn't know what the show was going to be about, and it all just hit too close to home because they lost their mother the day before I lost Paul. They literally lost their mother 10th of February 2022. And they didn't know that this was the show. And I am kind of aware of that sometimes. And I find it acutely aware on a Friday and Saturday night for some reason that people have bought tickets just because it's me and they went to the last show and maybe the show before that. And this is what, you know, and if anything, I am a comedian that people expect to be able to just forget about their troubles and just laugh at silly things in life. And that I'm not generally going to be processing my trauma on stage. So for those people, it can be a bit of a, oh, this is not what I signed up for when I bought a ticket. But the majority of people who've been, you know, if they've gotten in contact, and I have, sometimes they email my manager, sometimes it's through Twitter or Instagram. I lost my, or I haven't spoken to my brother in ages, or I haven't spoken to my sister, and I bought them tickets to see you in Melbourne, you know, that kind of stuff. And there's a guy who he has now since emailed, because it was a guy that I met just after the show at Edinburgh in like the first week of the run in Edinburgh, who had lost his brother to COVID January 2021. And he was there with his wife. And the really nice thing he said was that he now feels that his wife understands what he's been through better than he could have explained to her himself. And his wife just nodded, and that was, and then I said that in an interview on the radio, and he played that off iPlayer to his family, going, oh, this is what I said to him about the show, and this is what he's now saying about. So it, and that all made his, what happened with his family seem, I don't know, more special or whatever. Just that whole thing of everybody telling each other everybody else's stories, how helpful it is to all of us. Sure. To be discussing it. That's been the thing.
And I wondered about that as well, I suppose. You know, in a way, this podcast, the aim has always been to just have conversations about this, the reality of death and dying, mm-hmm. you know, in a kind of demystifying kind of way, or maybe, or an attempt at least. Mm-hmm. I'm sure your show is mm-hmm. doing loads. And that's why I was curious about how it was landing.
Yeah.
In terms of whether people are saying it in that way mm-hmm. to you.
Yeah, and but you know, the message at the end of the show is about, because there has to be a positive message, and it is that if you are currently estranged from a family member, whatever it is, it's, you know, don't wait until it's too late.
Yeah, and I was going to end myself with that, because it is a great point of ending, really, because everyone can relate to that. We all know when we go to bed with a bit of bad blood, mm-hmm. whether it's with our lover or our child or whatever we've left, and we're smarting or we're a bit more mm-hmm. wound up than we know, and we're just lying there uh-huh. just feeding that kind of beast and I must say, as I've grown older, I just do now try, even if it's with some reluctance, because I know it's usually my fault, I turn over and look, I am sorry.
People often use that phrase, treat every day as if it's your last, which I think is a terrible way to live your life, you know, because you would just end up running a terrible credit card debt. But I think maybe, and I'm just thinking out loud, this is not something I've ever said before, but it occurs to me that maybe a good way to behave is to treat everybody as if it's their last day, mm. because you never know, this could be the last time you ever see them. So don't leave things unresolved.
Yeah, because they hang around heavier, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
If they are unresolved, they just linger. I mean, I see it with other people a lot, where they have something, you know, and you talked about it in your show, not about yours, but about certain regrets you have about conversations was the area you were talking about. Mm-hmm. I wish I'd said so-and-so to something, and then, you know, how long ago was that one? That was 4 years ago. You know, and those things can really weigh, particularly with grief. I think if there's no grief involved, well, it can just be something that you wish a regret, if you like. Mm-hmm. When someone's died, that regret changes its status somehow. I don't know what it goes into from regret, but it changes it. It becomes solidifies in some way, because there's very little way of resolving it outside of a seance. Ed, you have been very generous, very honest, very open. Pleasure to sit opposite you in Bakewell Town Hall. Your show, as you said, goes on to the end of the year, and who knows, maybe even beyond.
Yes.
So should anyone be moved to do so, I would certainly urge them to go and get a ticket for a local show and have a really, really amazing night out.
Well, so, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
I really enjoyed the conversation with Ed. I was going to say he was really funny, but what he was very, very seriously engaged with the topic. He was very present throughout the conversation. And I was grateful for the honesty and openness with which he engaged. In fact, it was a pleasure. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, you can head to our website, ashgatehospice.org.uk, where you can find lots of resources. This episode was produced by Olivia Swift, and it's a Reform Radio production. You've been listening to the Life and Death podcast by Ashgate Hospice. I've been your host, Stephen. Thank you, and we'll see you again next time. This series is dedicated to Roy Hackett, who was our very first podcast guest. He died at the hospice in November 2023, and we're forever grateful for his generosity, wit, and wisdom.